Well, I wanted to have you into the studio when Budding Prospects came out.
As it happened, that unfortunately coincided with the fact that I was moving into a new house which needed lots of repairs, so I became a carpenter and painter for 2 months last year, and I didn't come out here at all. I did go to San Francisco and do some Los Angeles things, but I didn't come out. So I'm trying to make up for it this time around.
Well, And when they sent me Greasy Lake, they didn't send me very much in the way of biographical material, but I was, when I shook out Budding Prospects, I did see a couple of things here. Too late, I just shook it out. So I'd like you to tell me a little bit about yourself. I know you grew up in Westchester County, right?
Yeah, I grew up just outside of Peekskill, town of Cortland.
Uh-huh.
Writing a novel about that right now, in fact.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I'm...
Anybody in it we know?
Well, you know, I haven't made fun of the Dutch yet, so I figured I'd make fun of the Dutch with those wonderful names and those boots and hats that they used to wear. So I'm taking a look at the lower Hudson Valley from Indian times to the present.
Why don't you just come a little closer to this one?
Sure.
So you grew up in Cortland?
Mm-hmm.
Small town living?
Yeah,
very
much so.
Suburban,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It's lovely. In fact, when I come to New York, I stay with old friends up there, people I've known since I was 3 and 4 years old.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to school?
Lakeland High School in the town of Cortland.
Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Then I became a erstwhile musician and went to SUNY at Potsdam to do music, and decided after about 6 months I couldn't do any music, and finally gravitated towards English and history. Then I went on to the Writers' Workshop at Iowa, and then stayed there and did a Ph.D. in 19th century British literature.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, your first book, which I have, Vincent of Man, was that done at Iowa? Was that your thesis?
Yeah, pretty much. Some of those stories I did while I still lived in New York before I went out there to school. But that, some of those were my thesis stories, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you knew pretty well after... determining that being in music was not for you, that you definitely wanted to become a writer.
It took me a few years to decide that, yeah. Fortunately, I got my...
Did you want to be, or did you intend to finance yourself by teaching, or what? How did it work out?
I didn't have any intentions. I was just, a young schmuck, living in New York and thinking vaguely of writing. Began to write, fortunately published a few stories, and that gave me the confidence to apply to Iowa. I had never heard of any other graduate programs except that one. They accepted me, and it was a good experience. I met a lot of good people there who helped me out.
Iowa, I've talked to so many people from Iowa. Jane Ann Phillips is on here today. She studied there.
Mm-hmm. I know her well. She was there in my era. Yeah, yeah. Know her well.
God, that Iowa must have an incredible, incredible program.
It's only so good as the people who are teaching there. And in our day, it was quite good. I believe I had a choice my first semester of Gail Godwin, John Irving, Vance Brugeli, Fred Exley, and Raymond Carver. A lineup like that, you can't go wrong.
Terrific. Yes, I know Carver, I know Godwin. Irving, I'm going to meet. I met him once, but I'm going to have Irving in on Friday. I don't know the other. Fred Exley.
Fred Exley, a Fan's Notes. He's he writes about his own life, so he's done two books: Fan's Notes and Pages from Cold Island. He's a very funny, good writer, but of course he has to live 10 years before he can write a book because he writes about his own life. Irving was terrific. He was a student of Vance Brugeli, and. I studied with Vance, and when Vance left for Arizona, he introduced me to John, and then I studied with John. I also had the opportunity to study with John Cheever there, too.
I hope it wasn't one of Cheever's drinking periods.
Pretty much it was, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. But he was not a marvelous teacher or anything, but he was such a master of the story. To have a man like this take your work seriously means a lot.
I think so, too. And just knowing him, he just struck me as one of the most charming people. And I was shocked later when I found out how troubled his life was. Because I didn't know that. I mean, this was not the image that he gave to me.
He was 62 when he came to Iowa. And I guess he was having a lot of problems. And I think that was apparent at the time. He was always very supportive of me, and we actually became rather good friends, simply because when I would come back to Peekskill, you know, he was living in Ossining, 10 miles away, and he invited me over from time to time.
Have you ever taught?
I teach now. Uh-huh. I teach at USC. That's why I live in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I teach creative writing 2 afternoons a week, and that gives me pretty much all the time I need to do my writing because I work in the mornings.
This a full-time
yes.
position there
mm-hmm.
for you? You're going to stay there for a long time? Do you ever take any writing stints away from USC, you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've learned to work under any conditions, like in a bedroom, for instance, with a blazing stereo, jackhammers out in the street, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. I love to teach. The academic situation is fine for me. I don't really have to participate much in the committees and whatnot. That's not for me. In fact, I sneak in and sneak out. That suits me just fine.
In budding prospects, some friendly guys go up in the mountains and try to grow their own crop. This has never happened to you, has it?
It's closely based on a tale of friends of mine who related their tale to me, and it was such a wonderful and hilarious story. It's the old American dream. You get up early, you work hard, you have a good scheme. Well, obviously, you wind up being rich, and if you're rich, of course, you're happy, you know. But it doesn't necessarily work out that way.
These guys never heard of the plight of the American farmer, did they?
Well, the funny thing is that these characters, they did the mathematics. You know, if you grow so many plants, then you make so many dollars. They didn't even have a plant in their apartments, like not even a wandering Jew or a coleus, you know. So they were defeated by the elements. I thought that was a wonderful story. Had they been successful, I wouldn't have bothered to write the story, of course.
That was a wonderful characterization of that state highway patrolman in there who got his comeuppance in the end.
John Jerpbeck, yes.
Yes, what was it? How do you pronounce his name?
Jerpbeck. Yeah. He, of course, married the former Jeannie Jordan, who is now Jeannie Jordan Jerpbeck.
You have some wonderful stories in your new book called Greasy Lake. One of the stories that I liked especially was a story that I could see developed into a full novel that was On for the Long Haul, the survivalist story. Tell me a little bit about how that got into your mind.
Well, I'm very amused by this whole survivalist thing, of course, because how can you protect yourself in a world of accident, you know? You just can't do it. And I went to Montana to give some readings. And the big talk there was of the survivalist. I was in Missoula, Montana, a pretty small town in itself, but outside of Missoula, about 30 miles, were infinitely smaller towns, inhabited solely, it seems, by survivalists from L.A., who had come up there, you know, with their weapons and their food caches and everything to get away from it all and survive all the coming disasters, whatever they may be. And the problem was, the only people that kind of had friction with them were other survivalists, so they wound up shooting one another. I thought that was pretty interesting, that you leave L.A. to survive and wind up getting shot by another survivalist. So that's the genesis of that story, which is, of course, a hilarious story, like most of them in the book.
Yeah, and also they stake out a track right next door to your place. It winds up being just another place to live, only maybe property's a little longer, wider than in another town, but you're just... You haven't gone anyplace.
Right, it's the survivalist tract. It was sort of the tract homes for the survivalists. Yeah. This guy, Arkson, who developed it all, was
the... if the survivalists were really smart, they would just take over an existing derelict farm in Ohio someplace. You know, a lot of abandoned farms.
That's the point. They're not particularly smart. Of course, they may be laughing in another 6 months. Who knows? In my story, they weren't particularly smart, though. It's curious you should mention that could be a longer piece, because when it came out in Esquire, of course the movies all came sniffing around, and people want to develop this into a longer piece.
Oh yeah, I'd like to see. In fact, you left me hanging a little bit, because I want to see what happens next. Because you go on and on and on with that.
I think you know what happens at the end of that story.
Well, I had a feeling something bad was going to happen,
yeah.
If you were to extend this and playing it right, you know, you could have a whole new different ending. You don't want to have a whole book.
No, no. I wanted it to end with that that poor survivalist being one second from meeting his maker.
The other story that I particularly liked in here, Greasy Lake, which is the title story. How did this one come about in your mind?
I never write anything autobiographical. I'm uneasy with that. My stories are much more fantasies, stories from the imagination. This one, though, does have elements of autobiography. You know, growing up as a young punk in the suburbs, essentially what you do is drive around and look for trouble all the time. And I thought, what an interesting story if one of these characters was actually to find some trouble. And that's the genesis of that one.
So that one does have something that may or may not have happened to you in your background, huh?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Ike and Nina, I didn't take that one too seriously. That was just a lark, right?
Well, Ike and Nina.
Ike having an affair with Khrushchev's wife?
Yeah, hitherto unrevealed, of course. Yes, they had a deep... loving and sexual relationship. And,
are you serious?
Well, you know, if you'll notice, the narrator of the story has his own axe to grind, and just perhaps he's making the facts of history fit his own version for his own purposes. I just suggest that. George Plimpton published that one originally, and he ran some wonderful photographs from the old Life magazine when the Khrushchevs visited the U.S. He had one in particular that was terrific with Ike that is coming into the camera with Nina, and he's holding her arm. And I felt that was proof enough right there.
Did the photograph show Nina's legs?
Unfortunately, no. I don't think she had legs. Did she have legs?
Did she?
Sure.
Did she? She had enough for Khrushchev. Let's see, there was another. Oh, the overcoat, too, which is set in the Soviet Union. That was a very touching... story. It had some feelings of the old Russian writers in that story.
Well, it's the overcoat, too. Yeah. I was having fun with Gogol and his hero, Akaky Akakievich. And I just wanted to see if perhaps conditions had changed since the days of the Empire, you know? And in my version, perhaps they haven't.
Well, from what I've read, they have not. Still have terrible shortages. You are obviously comfortable with the short story form, but you've produced two novels, and did you say you were working on another novel now?
Yes. I'm about a third of the way through a novel called World's End, which I described earlier. It deals with the Dutch and the Hudson River Valley.
That's right.
And it's also driving me crazy right now. You know, it's very difficult to take on a long project, as this one is, that requires a great deal of research, and to maintain your interest over the long haul, and to maintain the same tone, in fact. I find it very difficult in a longer work. You mentioned Budding Prospects, which I did as a sort of a release after doing Water Music, which is another very complex project.
The main project now, but Cortland, well, not about Cortland, I guess it's about the Hudson Valley, huh? How do you...
But in that area, it's set in the Peekskill area.
Well, but you do interrupt it, don't you, occasionally to write short stories, or if some thought comes to mind.
No, I don't. No, I just jot the short story ideas down, and when the novel is finished, then I begin to write them. And that's a release in itself, because, of course, when you've done a long project, you're exhausted, and you can't imagine ever starting another project like that again. And many novelists who don't do stories go through a period of depression, and they think it's inevitable. I so far have been lucky enough to avoid that because the story ideas begin to emerge then, and it's very satisfying to be able to do a work in a month, let's say, and have it out. Maybe somebody will buy it. You can come home and get champagne that day, you know, and have a little celebration, as opposed to working endlessly for years on a longer project.
What's it like for a writer living in Los Angeles?
For me, it's terrific because I get a lot of publicity in Los Angeles simply because I'm not interested in working for the movies. And that seems to intrigue everybody in town. In a town, of course, where every cab driver and house painter and gardener is writing scripts, of course, you know. And I don't want to write any scripts. I have no desire to do it. And that that makes me unique in a way. The first Hollywood person I met was a producer connected with Paramount, and he said to me, so what are you doing now? I said, I'm writing a novel. It's a few years back. And he said, for whom? I said, for no one. I'm just writing a novel. He said, on spec? You know, they just have a slightly different mentality out there. You know? I said, well, I write a novel. That's what I do. I'm a writer.
Are you married?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Family?
I have two children, a daughter of five, a son of two.
So what kind of, where do you work out of your house, obviously, huh?
Mm-hmm, yes.
How do you have that set up so that you're not...
We bind and gag them for 6 to 8 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense, yeah. You keep them relatively quiet. Do you have an attic someplace?
No, actually, you know, I've...
Oh, you don't have to, the noise doesn't bother you.
Yeah, I had to work around the space limitations in the past, so I've developed an ability to write while two stereo speakers are affixed to either side of my head, blotting out all sounds. Now I have slightly larger and better accommodations, and I do have my own office, but these stereo speakers are still a fixture in there, and they do pretty much put me into my own world.
Do you know Herb Gold, who lives in Los Angeles?
I know his work,
San Francisco?
But I've never met him.
He's a very interesting guy, and he's kind of like you. He will write anytime, anywhere, on anything, whether it's outdoors, on a bus. He'll sit in a bar and write.
Well, actually, I have to correct you. That's unlike me. I can only write in the office with that stereo going. No, I find it very difficult to work. When I say that wherever I'm living, I establish a place to write. But I, unlike Herb Gold or Trollope, for instance, I can't write on a bus or so on. I have to be locked away and concentrating. What I was trying to say earlier is that you must make your own space wherever you're living and under whatever conditions.
I dabble at writing, not successfully, but recently I got a Macintosh computer, and after using this old Smith Corona manual typewriter for years, I just can't. Do you use a word processor or anything?
Well, how many years were you using that Smith Corona?
About close to 30.
Ah, well, when I get to my 30 with my old Olivetti that my mother gave me when I went away to college, then maybe I'll think about the computer. Give me 30.
Well,
give me another 15 years.
I just got this thing, and I tell you, if you haven't used one...
I have played with them extensively. What it would help me in is the constant revision I do. I work, perhaps I write a page or so a day of new material, but I'm constantly revising what I've written before. And it would help because, you know, you have a problem in the middle of the page and you keep retyping the page and finally you see something at the top of the page that seemed good before and you work on it. But I enjoy that because it's suffering. I like to suffer so much.
The computer will take that suffering away. See, I wasn't sold on it until I began to actually use it. And I'm like you, too. I try to write. Sometimes I do my scripts for my broadcast and home. And I don't like a messy page, and I keep using whiteout and then retyping. If you have to add a sentence in the middle of the page, what happens? You have to retype the whole page, but not with
Well, I'm not quite such a perfectionist as that. I scribble it in my own inimitable scrawl, which I then later can't read, of course. No, but I think that the suffering is very good. not to be facetious, but I think that this the busy work that I do, sometimes I think that is what enables me at some other a level other than the conscious level to figure out where that story is going and what's happening next. And also, I'm just a crank. In fact, if I see one more ad for a computer, I think I'm going to go back to parchment with a quill pen and a candle.
Well, as of next month, by the middle of next month, we are still using old manual typewriters in this newsroom, but 14 new computer terminals are being set up in our newsroom. So this whole, and it's already computerized on the other side of the building, all of our logs and everything computerized. Tell me about the origin of this very unusual name and also how to pronounce it.
That's T. Karagason Boyle, but my friends just call me Tom. Makes life a little easier. It's an Irish name that's been in the family. And my English publisher, Galanx, asked me to shorten my name to T.C. Boyle on the cover. Inside it can be T. Karagason Boyle. Because they felt that it was too aggressively Irish for their audience in England. So I said, okay, sure. You want to be T.C. Boyle? Let's keep it T.C. Boyle.
Well, you're certainly an engaging guy. I really appreciate your taking the time out. I wanted to have you in a year or so ago, and I'm glad that we were able to connect this time. I'm certainly looking forward to reading this this new book, which probably won't be out for quite a while.
I'm hoping, I'm looking for 1987 with that one.
Well, maybe I'll still be here. The show's been on now for many years, and I've been here for 18. So chances may be okay that I'll still be here if they keep the show. If Ted Turner doesn't buy us out and sell us. No plans at all to leave California, huh? You're a Californian for good now, huh?
Not at present. Yeah, I guess I'm an L. Asian or an Angelino, however you want to say it. I will say that the press in Los Angeles is very supportive of me, and I appreciate that.
There are no other writers out there.
That's right, yeah. I guess so. Well, it seems like a perfect situation then. How could I leave?
Ever consider taking a teaching assignment outside of...
Yeah, California? I will do that. I had a sabbatical last year, which helped me to get going on the new novel. And I've been asked by several places to come and do a semester or so. And I like to do that to get... I haven't done it yet, but I think it would be nice to for a change of scene.
Can you get off easily enough?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. In fact... they've asked me to come out to the writer's workshop, and I'm contemplating doing that at one point in the next couple of years.
Well, maybe you'll consider going to my alma mater at some point, which is Ohio University. Hopefully, they're going to be having a full-time visiting writer program there, trying to help them get one started. Herb Gold taught there briefly, but it's not a permanent program, but I'm on the National Alumni Board, and because of my own interest in literature and books, I've been trying to help them start one and help raise the funds for it.
I began a writing program at USC. That was what they hired me for, and I'm fairly well committed to it. There's an awful lot of interest. My classes are always oversubscribed. I'm pleased when my students do well. Some of them stay with me for years. The best of them are in very fine graduate programs around the country now, and some of them are publishing, too, and I get a tremendous gratification from that.
I'd like to see them do it there. It's a terrific school for communications, but they have, more recently, they seem to have tilted their interest in various forms of technology. I mean, for example,
uh-oh.
They have a... You know, I hate to see them forget the humanity. For example, they have a gas well. You know, they got about $250,000 from some company in Texas, gave them this money on the condition that they drill for gas.
On campus?
On campus. So they got it's not on the green itself, but off near the near the campus golf course. And
well,
so,
maybe they could coordinate with that with the writing program, because, of course, writers don't make any money. So maybe they could learn a useful skill. And, you know, take writing courses at night.
Well, if the thing goes up, explodes, you know, there's got to be some writers there to describe it.
Yeah, okay.
To describe the torture and the anguish of the families gathered around the hole in the golf course.
Fair enough.
Tom Boyle, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me, and I hope we can do this again at some point and chat some more about books and your work.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hang on a second.